808 FM Talk 106.5 and Mobile Mornings on this Get Back to Work Tuesday. Glad to have you here. Text lines open at 343-0106. Also, it is a Tuesday, and that's when we check in with our buddy Quinn Hillier from QuinnHillier.com, also the author of the Mad Jones trilogy. That if you're looking for summer reading, Quinn, how do they get their hands on that?
Just go to Amazon.com, type in Mad Jones or Quinn Hillier. You should be able to find it.
All right. Lots to talk about this morning. But before we even get into the political discussion, you have a story over at the Washington Examiner. As NFL role model, Bart Starr was the greatest of all time. We talked about his passing from over the weekend, but you have a claim here. The best, greatest of all time. What, the greatest QB? Who, greatest what?
Well, I said as an NFL role model, he was the greatest of all time. And he actually, I make a case that he deserves to be in the conversation for greatest quarterback of all time, and for some reason he is overlooked. He should be listed there in the top five or so, and he should be part of the discussion. And everybody just says, oh, well, you know, credit Lombardi and Starr was just a game manager, but that's actually not at all true. I mean, the man was a really, really good football player and was better even than Joe Montana in the clutch.
You know, we talk about Tom Brady seemingly every year and how he was drafted in the sixth round and then went on to win all of his world titles. But Bart Starr drafted in the 17th round of the 1956 draft, back when they drafted way more than the seven rounds they do today. So he didn't have a crazy good career at Alabama, but his NFL career is where he turned things around.
Well, it's interesting. Tom Brady and Bart Starr were both picked with the 199th pick. How do you like that?
There were
more teams
right
under Brady, so the seventh round then was picking the same number of players as 17 rounds back in 1956. But they were both picked with the 199th pick in the draft, which
wow
is really interesting. And, of course, they're the two quarterbacks with the most NFL championships in history, and Starr did his five in 7 years, and he came so close to it actually being 6 out of 8 years. And I can tell you about the 1960 game, but people forget, but the Packers really should have won that game, and Vince Lombardi made a couple of mistakes, and even so, the game ended with Chuck Bednarik tackling Jim Taylor on the 10-yard line as the last player, the last defensive player between Taylor and the goal line. So it could have been 6 out of 8.
Amazing. And Bart Starr, he's a guy, I mean, he's Alabama through and through, born in Montgomery, died in Birmingham, played ball in Tuscaloosa, but not really thought of as much as an Alabama quarterback as, say, Joe Namath.
No, but, you know, the sad thing about it is, people forget he was a heck of a quarterback in college. He started as a sophomore and led Alabama to the Cotton Bowl, and then he hurt his back badly in a fraternity hazing incident. He was being hazed, and at that time the hazing was really brutal, and he hurt his back, and so he couldn't play as a junior. And as a senior, they had a new coach, and he rode the bench. The new coach basically didn't know him and thought he was washed up because of his back was hurt, and they didn't win a single game. And so he was sort of an afterthought, and the only reason the Packers drafted him was there was like a high school basketball coach who was a friend of an assistant coach or something like that, and they said, you really should try this Starr guy, he's got some grit. And so they took a flyer on him, and the rest is history.
Now, okay, so you want to, number one, point out the history. Number two, you're pushing for him to get some respect, to you, even posthumously here, in the state or nationally?
Nationally. I mean, look, people who say, well, his statistics weren't all that great, that was a different era. I mean, you're talking about a time when all the rules favored the defenses. The wide receivers could be just about tackled anywhere on the field as long as the ball wasn't in the air. There wasn't any of this, you know, 5-yard no chuck limit. Holding was a 15-yard penalty. I mean, they could go on and on and on. And yet star statistics for the era were actually really, really good. He had 1 year where he had 15 touchdowns and only 3 interceptions. He led the league in passing completion 4 times, including 2 times after Lombardi left. He led in quarterback rating 4 times, including 2 times after Lombardi left. I mean, I could go on and on and on, and then you get to his playoff record, 9 wins, 1 very, very narrow loss. In the six championship games, if I remember right, 1 interception in something, what do I write, 240 passes or
wow.
Something like that. I mean, just phenomenal. Puts Joe Montana's clutch record to shame.
Okay, so who's the Bart Starr of today?
Well, the closest to that was almost today was Peyton Manning in terms of not just on the field but off the field, sort of the reputation as a good guy and a straight shooter. Because that's why I was saying that Bart Starr, whether or not he was the greatest quarterback of all time, and I think he was within the top 5 or so, and maybe the best, but he was certainly the greatest role model of all time, because what he did off the field, the way he conducted himself, the charitable work that he did, which was phenomenal all through his life. Jerry Kramer said that Bart Starr came as close to perfection as any man he ever met.
Wow.
And that he kept looking for a chink in his armor, kept hoping just to see that Starr had some horrible flaw that he was hiding, and he never saw it, playing alongside the guy for 11 years. He said he was just a truly nice, decent, straight-shooting Christian, leader by example who just tried to do the right thing.
All right, coming back from the break, we'll switch gears here from a celebration of a person to a condemnation of the Democrats and their impeachment talk. Quinn says impeaches their own credibility. More on that coming up after the break. Phone number, text line 343-0106, 343-0106. Quick reminder, too, we had mentioned it yesterday and again this morning, but linked up that GoFundMe page that's been posted for the family of the now late Rod and Paula Bramlett, their children. Joshua, the son, a 10th grader at Auburn High School, and their daughter Shelby, a sophomore at Auburn. The link there to the GoFundMe page is up. You can click there. Over $139,000 raised so far to help these children who have now become orphans in just a blink of an eye. Wow. 8:16. Be right back. Hey, thank you, Kane. 8:19 FM Talk 106.5. At Mobile Mornings, welcome back. Checking in with Quinn Hillier from QuinnHillier.com. The impeachment discussion in Washington, you say what, Quinn, to the Democrats?
They're acting like partisan political hacks. And look, you know,
well, that's what Washington's full of,
your
right?
Your regular listeners know that I am no fan of Donald Trump.
Right.
But
they're familiar, yes.
But just because I'm not a fan of his doesn't mean that, you know, I'm going to reflexively say that Trump is in the wrong every time. And what the Democrats are doing right now in talking impeachment this early in the game, going on this little, even remotely impeachable evidence, is horrible for our republic. It's early, it's not justified, and it's just wrong. I mean, impeachment is a serious, serious business. And as I explain in my column out today, they do not have grounds to even talk about opening an impeachment inquiry yet.
Now, I would, you know, I argued last week that it would behoove the president, I think, to just come out and say, hey, y'all got something here? Let's go with it. Let's get a move on it. You know, instead of letting this hang out there and be some kind of, the gorilla in the room going forward to 2020, let's go ahead and do this. If y'all have got the votes, then y'all quit talking about it and just go ahead and do it. Because in a conversation I had with Congressman Byrne last week, he said he didn't think they had enough votes to move forward. That's why it's just rhetoric and nothing more.
Well, it is sort of rhetoric and nothing more, except that what they're trying to do is get the media to repeat their charges often enough that it puts the pressure on their so-called moderates to actually switch to being worried about impeachment to maybe, if push comes to shove, voting for it. And that's why they're doing all this, all of these hearings, which, you know what, I think it's okay. It's proper oversight to do some hearings if you go about them soberly, if you don't decide in advance that your goal is to nail somebody, but instead actually look into something that is of the public's business. But these people have decided their verdict first, and now they're just desperately searching for evidence to support the verdict of guilty of an impeachable offense. And you know, I went through very carefully the various possible reasons to open an impeachment inquiry right now, and they're just not there. I mean, on the big one right now, the one where they, you know, have Michael Cohen, the former lawyer, saying that Trump, you know, did something that was fraudulent on his taxes because he claimed less income here and more income there or whatever. Okay, if he's got some documents, have him show it. But right now, you can't open an impeachment inquiry on the just on the oral testimony of an admitted perjurer. That's just wrong. I mean, you've got to have something more to go on than that.
Yeah, I think the Democrats would like this just to hang out there and be a subject of discussion on into 2020 without moving forward on this, because you know, you project uncertainty versus you know, getting it done and having some certainty. So I think the benefit for the Democrats is to keep this alive, nurse this along going forward. Because let's talk about the logistics, Quinn. Right? It's the House controlled by the Democrats. They can send it to the Senate, but it's not going to go through the Senate unless there's something I can't imagine happening.
Well, yeah, but Republicans knew the same thing in 1998 and early 99 with Bill Clinton, and they felt they had to impeach anyway. And I actually thought that, you know, that they almost had no choice, because in an ongoing investigation there was direct perjury by a president. You just can't let that happen. In this case, the Democrats don't have perjury. In fact, they don't have evidence that Trump suborned perjury. What they do have is evidence that he talked about something that might be obstruction of justice, but his aides either talked him out of it or didn't follow through. And the analogy I use is, if you're talking about stealing something from a car that has an open window, you talk about it with your buddy, and you walk up to the car, and then you say, "No, I'm not going to do it," and you walk away. You haven't committed a crime. Well, the same thing with Trump. He might have talked about obstructing justice on the two or three times when it was would have most clearly been obstruction, but they didn't do anything to obstruct justice, so you can't charge him with just some kind of nefarious intent. You have to have a crime or the political equivalent of a crime, and they do not have that, and it's absurd to say that they do.
You know, Quinn, we've seen most of the calls for impeachment come from the far left, you know, the AOCs, the Tlaibs, but last week, a Republican actually calling for impeachment, Justin Amash from Michigan. What's with a Republican all of a sudden joining the ranks to calling for impeachment?
Justin Amash is sort of a weird dude. He's sort of an extreme libertarian. People say he's principled, but he's an oddball. I mean, there was a time that John McCain said, you know, people were acting like monkeys, which is used to be a common expression. It wasn't even about, you know, there was no racial thing involving blacks, but they happened to be Asians. And he said, you know, they're just acting like monkeys, meaning they're acting foolish. And Justin Amash came out and said that proves that John McCain is racist. And, you know, you can say a lot of bad things about John McCain, but to say he's racist is just absolutely absurd. And even to say that reference was racist was absurd. So I just use that as an example of how Justin Amash is sort of a strange cat. And he looked at the evidence of obstruction and thought that it was enough to impeach. Most people have looked at it and said, it's sort of gray area, borderline, and shows that Trump was a bad guy. He might have tried to impede the investigation, but he actually turned over all the documents, and he actually let his aides testify. There was no material information that we know of that he kept from getting out, even though he talked about it. So I think Amash is wrong, even though I can't stand Trump.
You know, while there's people that who aren't fans of Trump that probably are not real happy with some of the predictions out now. You've got to, now, of course, these are just predictions, and they could be wrong. But a story, I think Axios had it out this morning, three people doing political modeling have concluded that President Trump will win re-election. They have Ray Fair, professor at Yale, Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's, and Donald Luskin of Trend Macrolytics have all reached the same conclusion. Looking at, I guess they've analyzed the Electoral College and what they think is going to happen. They think President Trump wins 2020.
That's very interesting and very possible. I mean, usually with an economy that, at least at the surface numbers, if an economy is this strong, the president gets reelected. I would argue that some of it's a sugar high funded by debt, but still, low unemployment, low inflation should mean, and if you're not at war, not at an unpopular war, the president usually gets reelected. So I think it's quite possible.
All right, Quinn, we will talk about this more next week. Remind folks once again, everything you write, you kind of put through your website, or would they just go to the Washington Examiner? What's the best way to get your
they
articles?
They can do either one. Most of the things I write do end up at Washington Examiner, not all, but Quinn Hill, your Washington Examiner, or you can go to my website, which should, by the way, which was just updated last night, quinnhillier.com.
Okay, and the book, the trilogy, how they get
Mad Jones, Mad Jones Heretic, Mad Jones Hero, Mad Jones Agonist, is available at Amazon.com. It's a fun read, really, seriously. Buy it, it's cheap. Buy it, read it, you'll like it.
Good stuff. Quinn, we appreciate it. We'll talk next week.
Thanks so much.
All right, Quinn Hill, you're checking in. And we want to hear from you at 343-0106. Yeah, it was pretty interesting, the Axios story here. Three forecast modelers, and we don't mean weather forecast, we mean political forecasters, predict President Trump will win in 2020. It says here, Steve Ratner, Karzar, and counselor to the Treasury Secretary in the Obama administration, cites three different modelers in his New York Times commentary. Trump's formidable 2020 tailwind is the name of the story. The big picture here, President Trump wins all three modelers. Economists predict that the tailwind is large. How about, why didn't they say huge?
huge. They huge. Missed out on an easy layup.
Ray Fair, professor at Yale, said he found that the growth rates of the gross domestic product and inflation have been the two most important economic predictors, but he also found that incumbency was also an important determinant of presidential election outcomes. I think that's fair to say. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, has looked at 12 models, and Mr. Trump wins in all of them, says Zandi. And Donald Luskin of Trend Macrolytics has reached the same conclusion in his examination of the Electoral College. So what do Democrats have to do? I think they have to keep things, at least in their opinion, like, oh, well, he might be impeached alive. I think the president should say, man, y'all want to do this? Go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and do it. I think they would like to keep this going into 2020. I would say it would behoove the president to nip it in the bud, but we'll see where that goes. I'll hear from you when we get back at 343-0106.
Thirty-six here on FM Talk 106.5. This is Mobile Mornings. Right now we head to McConnell Automotive, where we talk to Mitch McConnell. Hey, Mitch.
All right, Dalton. How are you, buddy? Hope everybody had a great Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, we're doing great here at FM Talk 106.5. And coming up on Friday, the very last day of May. Now, usually the end of the month, a good time to get out to McConnell Automotive and look for deals.
Yeah, Dalton, I mean, anybody that's been shopping for cars in the last few years that have been disappointed, a lot of people are disappointed, Dalton, because they don't really get the deals that the dealership actually advertises, which sounds a little crazy to me because we've been doing this for over 60 years. But what's so exciting about what McConnell does every day, Dalton, is these sales that we have and the prices we post on our website, you know, they're the best on the Gulf Coast, and we actually honor those prices with no hassle. So I think the big thing I want everybody to do is picture in their mind that we've got 0% interest. We've got some of the biggest discounts we've ever had on the new 19 truck that includes the X31, the AT4, buddy, and Yukons. I'm talking about every Buick we have, and I think it's 16% off. So the Memorial Day sale is not over, not for us anyway. And we're going to run it all the way through Friday, so we just want people to hurry up, take advantage of the deals, and check our website out or come see us, Dalton.
All right. Thank you, Mitch. Have a good one.
Everybody,
that's Mitch McConnell. Go check out McConnellAutomotive.com or go see him and the crew in person at McConnell Automotive. You'll find him on Dolphin Street just east of I-65.
All right. Phone line, text line open at 343-0106. We talked about a couple stories. Oh, did you see the private wall being built?
No. So is this on the Mexican
on
border?
On the border. So the, you know, the question about, like, remember when we had the idea of somebody, I think it was actually came out of the legislator out of here in Alabama. I know there was a private citizen and then legislator from North Alabama got on board with this idea of private money going to the government to finance a wall, and the government said, you can't do that.
Yeah, even a GoFundMe was started.
That's right.
If I remember
correctly.
Yeah,
and they said that you can do the GoFundMe, but you can't give that money to the... Okay, well, look at this. Private group on Monday, story from Washington Times, said private group announced Monday that has constructed a half-mile wall along a section of the U.S.-Mexico border in New Mexico, said it was the first in this border state. The 18-foot steel bollard wall is similar to the design used by Border Patrol, sealing off part of the border that has been a striking gap in existing fencing, according to the people at We Build the Wall, the group behind the new section. Section was also built faster, and organizers say likely more cheaply than the government has been able to manage in recent years. Chris Kobach, former Secretary of State in Kansas and an informal immigration advisor to President Trump, says the New Mexico project has the president's blessing and says local Border Patrol agents are eager to have the assistance. Mr. Kobach, who is general counsel for We Build the Wall, said, we're closing the gap. That's been a big headache for them. The announcement comes at a critical time for the border. But yeah, there you go. So I guess private money, and on the way I heard the story, it was on private property. So it's not on government property. I guess you could have your private property go the whole way right there to the border, you know.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it would be nice. What kind of easements or setbacks? You wouldn't have to have any kind of setbacks.
No.
It'd be international law. You wouldn't have to have, like, your home has to be back this far from this border. But yeah, they put this, obviously, it's for the sake of discussion there, but the private business putting up this wall.
I want to see, you know, how much money it would take, how far they can build a private wall, first off, because like you said, you'd have to find the private property to build it on. But then once we get those walls, you know, going, and some more federal money goes into building federal walls, suppose that actually comes to fruition, I want to see a dollar-by-dollar breakdown, see which dollar goes further, the private wall or the one that all the federal money's going into.
Well, you know, what'll happen is it'll be the federal wall will meet up with the private wall, but then the private wall will not meet the standards set of the federal wall. So you have to bring down the private wall and rebuild it to federal construction levels. All right. We talk about that some, but there's a story I thought about this from yesterday, and I want to just, maybe you're familiar with this going on, maybe you're not. It was of note when I saw the story, the number of families involved in this. And I just want to read through a story from, it's a couple different places. If you Google this subject, you'll get the story. This from the goodnewsnetwork.org. Listen to this. So on this day after Memorial Day, it says here, for the people of a small village in the Netherlands, every day is Memorial Day for thousands of American soldiers buried nearby. For nearly for 70 years, and this would be 72 years now, the people of Margraten have personally cared for the graves of Americans killed in World War II, 8,300 of them, in a military cemetery outside of town. Each American grave there is adopted by a Dutch, Belgian, or even German family who make sure the service member buried there is remembered. The thousands of families deliver flowers on their soldier's birthday or date of death and decorate the graves on Christmas and Memorial Day. To this day, there's still a waiting list 100 families long for grateful citizens to become memorial caretakers. And, you know, you watch, like, Saving Private Ryan was on 18 times yesterday or in the war movies, and you think about American dead that were buried there in the battlefield and whose bodies didn't come home. You go to Normandy, you see the graves there, you see Margrutten, and where their families, if they're still connected, are a world away from those graves. Hear these families in Europe, and you think, you know, I guess you watch something like a World War II movie and think about the Greatest Generation and say, have those people forgotten? And maybe the young Euro punks have, but there's 83 in this one cemetery, Margrutten, 8,300 U.S. graves, okay? And there's a waiting list 100 families long to be able to be one of the families dedicated to that American's grave, to decorate it, to make sure it's taken care of, to put the flowers on it, to do that. Somebody that they most likely never knew, have no connection to, no family connection. It's not their family. They take it upon themselves. So there's still people that show that. It's a beautiful story. I'm going to pop it up on Twitter, but it's really something.
That just shows how incredibly nice humans can be, you know, even continents away. And it's pretty striking compared to a lot of even Americans. And I don't think it's generally a problem. I think most Americans are very thankful for the sacrifices that so many of our servicemen and women have, you know, gone through, and a lot of our own soldiers who have died while fighting in wars on our behalf. But a lot of Americans, I don't think, would do that, what they're doing for us over in the Netherlands.
Somebody,
I mean, a waiting list to take care of American memorials.
It's showing the enduring gratitude for the Allies and the Americans in this case, and their freeing of those places in Europe. But you think, as decades go by, that would wear away. You know, it's the 9/12 experience, right? The day after 9/11, how the solidarity of our country, and over the months and years, it goes back to factionalism, not fascism, factionalism, you know, balkanization. You look here in Europe, here all these decades later, there are families that I would argue weren't even obviously alive at the time of liberation, that have continued to do the work every year to take care of these American graves there. I thought it was kind of a special angle on this, and that's why I brought it up and put the link up. Yeah,
think about how, you know, grateful, how thankful the families of those people are, those people who were buried over there, how thankful the families are that are over here, that someone all the way in the Netherlands is taking care of there.
I guess they know. There's a couple stories where they have put one woman who has been taking care of graves for 70 years.
Wow.
There, they put her just last year in touch with the nieces of the American soldier, the private, that is buried there. They put them in touch, this lady, with the nieces of that soldier, and got them together. But that's the connection. I mean, those nieces, I don't think, had been there before or whatever, and they put her in connection with this person that goes and sees their uncle's the grave. So
incredible.
It's something neat, something that is, I don't think, publicized enough, what's still going on in Europe there. So check out the story. The link is up on the Twitter feed. All right, coming back, we'll grab some calls at 343-0106. They're back to work today in Montgomery. Going to wrap it. It looks like, unless something changes, they'll be wrapping it up by Friday. You know, usually they gavel in on a Tuesday, gavel out on a Thursday. They may actually go through Friday and wrap it up for this 2019 regular session of the legislature in Montgomery. Now, remember, there's a special session still part of the discussion to deal with prisons that looks like it's September, October on the docket for them. Coming right back. And with that being said, maybe we should bill by the minute or the... So those that call just to check in, don't want to come on the air, don't want to call to visit with the main man in the screening room there, Philip. He's got like his job is for the on air product.
Right.
So if you're calling just to chat, maybe send him a text or something. You know. All right. 850 FM Talk 106.5 in Mobile Morning. Phone number 343-0106. If you want to get on the air, if you just want to visit with Philip, we'll just have like a. You just have like a separate phone line, or maybe one of those little chat boxes.
The Power Hour,
and you can chat right there. You know how it'll give you a choice when you go to customer service.
Mm-hmm.
You can call and stay on hold forever, or you can have your little. How can we help you?
Right,
and then you can chat with Philip that way. What do you think?
Well, I mean, that works for me.
It'll work. Hey, speaking of good news out of very, very bad news, you were talking about the GoFundMe page for the children of the Bramlets.
Yeah, so I know a lot of people might just be getting back to the real world today after a long Memorial Day weekend, but sad news on Saturday as the voice of the Auburn Tigers, Rod Bramlett, and his wife, Paula, killed in a car crash in Auburn. Rod, 52 years old, his wife, Paula, 53, both passed away in that accident, and they left behind a couple kids. They've got a son, Joshua, who's going to be a 10th grader at Auburn High School coming up this fall, and a daughter, Shelby, who's actually at Auburn University. She's a sophomore this year, and those two left behind with their parents, Rod and Paula, killed on Saturday. And there has been a GoFundMe set up for them. It's the Rod and Paula Bramlett Family Memorial Fund, and these donations go towards Shelby and Joshua, and they've raised, so far, a goal of $200,000. They've raised $147,000 of that $200,000 goal, but some awful, awful news over the weekend with the news that Rod and Paula Bramlett have passed away, but the GoFundMe right now up to $147,000.
All right, good stuff there. As, you know, they're, I mean, in an instant, those children are orphans. I mean, in an instant.
Mm.
And, you know, I've talked about it yesterday and some this morning. And I've gotten to be friends with Rod over the years, and it really stinks. And it still it's hurting a lot of people out there. He was one of the good guys. And I did not know his wife. I'd never met Paula, but met Rod many occasions and talked to him weekly. And just a good dude.
Yeah.
Man, just a good dude.
Really good guy. You know, he came on Sports Night, my show on Monday nights, and talk about something he didn't have to do. I mean, we're talking about a show on Monday night at 7:30.
The Greatest, which, by the way, is up for a nappy.
It is up for a nappy. And Rod Bramlett, to come on that show, I mean, I was floored when he agreed to come on the show, but that just shows how good of a guy he is. That was during Auburn's run, during the basketball March Madness, when they made it into the Final Four. He came on the air with us and talked, and you had a really nice, long conversation with him. Well, you've had several, but you had one on the air back in 2015 and kind of explaining his career and how he got into broadcast. And just an outstanding conversation, a really great guy. But for me, that news with his death on Saturday, I mean, it just shows you how soon something like that can happen to anybody.
Yeah.
52 years old, the voice of the Auburn Tigers we're talking about here. I mean, he was still in the middle of this baseball season, which Auburn has now been named to one of the teams that will play in the 64-team field of the NCAA World Series. And he was still calling games all the way up until last week. And to pass away the way that he did, it stopped the world for me for a minute. Where I'm like, wow, that can truly happen to anyone. But with these donations, so many rolling in. Actually, a lot of people donating $109 to the GoFundMe. And you wonder why. It's that famous kick six call from back in 2013 where Chris Davis caught the ball in the air, caught the field goal, and ran it back, and Auburn ended up winning the game. So a lot of people donating $109 towards Rod Bramlett's Memorial Fund because of that kick six call kind of in his memory.
Yeah, but so your hearts are heavy around here. One of the good guys gone, that interview, and Dalton's, you can catch those on our podcast page, fmtalk1065.com. Just click the link for podcast. Grab a call here. John is in Mobile. Hey, John.
Hey, guys. Has there been any more information released about that wreck?
I guess
they were stopped at a light in Auburn.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not familiar with the intersection, but I was hanging out. Jeff Poore and his wife came through this weekend. I got to talk to them some. And Jeff obviously spent a lot of time there, graduated from Auburn, and talked about that intersection being kind of a dangerous area.
Yeah, it's the Shug Jordan Parkway and West Samford Avenue where those two roads intersect. And I've heard that that's a dangerous intersection. But the word from Saturday was that Rod and his wife were there on Shug Jordan turning off onto West West Samford when they were rear-ended by a 16-year-old driver. At the time, police said that alcohol was not a factor, but they are, you know, investigating the case to see what would have caused this 16-year-old to run into them.
That kid must have been hauling.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the kid's in, yeah, kid was in, I think, still in the hospital as well, but, I mean, you think the one that survived, the child, that person's life is going to be affected forever, too. I mean, it's just it's a sad, and listen, it's sad all around. It's just, I guess, even more for us because we got to know him, and you know, in the broadcast business, there are a lot of good people, but he was definitely, he's definitely one of the top. He's one of the, like, best guys. He and I had no reason to get along, and we got along famously, so.
And on a lighter note, I'm the guy that sent you the picture of my son's roommate's feet at Dolphin Island.
Okay, that was it. With it can't be sunburned because at the bottom it's sandburned feet, right?
Correct. That's correct.
Sandburned feet. That's
when my son dropped the guy off. He just knows his shoes and says, "Hey, I'll walk on the beach." And so when my son got parked, he gets a call. He says, "Hey, bring your flip flops." Just like. Okay, he said, "Bring my flip flops too." So I got a problem.
I'm gonna have to put
that's
a
picture. How hot it was!
Yeah, y'all, we're looking at the picture John sent. That is a blister on the bottom of the foot from the sand.
It's huge blister.
I mean,
so
wait, that anyway, wasn't from parking lot. That was on the sand, on the white sand.
On the sand, 100% sand.
Man. Unbelievable. Now, Sean, I know you're not as much of a beach guy. I mean, right. You love the water. You're more of a boat guy.
Yeah.
Get out there onto the dock, onto the boat, go fishing.
Right.
I do a lot of beaching. And there's just a certain point of the year where it's, all right, I'm wearing shoes out to the beach. I'll take them off once I get to where I'm sitting.
Where there's water.
Yep. Where there's water. But we have reached that point in the year where you're basically stepping on a stove when you get out there.
John, I am. That is the first time I've ever seen a blister like that from sand. That's unreal. Thank you for the picture.
Yeah, when he sent it, when my son sent it to us, I was like, "You're kidding me!" And he's like, "Wow." So anyway,
but get him some. And appreciate the call. Get him some weathered feet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I don't have them anymore because, like, I'm a grown up and have to wear shoes all the time and boots and stuff. But when I was a kid,
Leather.
Good, come on, Southern kid feet developed from not wearing shoes a whole bunch. You know, I mean, you had to wear them to certain places, but as soon as you're just goofing off and walking on concrete and all that stuff, you know the kind of walk you do when something's hot or hurts, you kind of high step your knees.
you're right.
What you're doing is just building calluses, man.
I've lost it too.
I used cauterizing your skin.
I used to have the Southern kid feet too. I'd walk out on the.
Now we have baby feet.
I've got those New Balance feet now. I'm weak.
Dad feet. All right. Be back at noon today for Midday Mobile. Mike Gallagher on the way next.